Welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. This podcast is brought to you in association with Game Refinery. Join us as we uncover the latest trends in mobile game design.
Hello and welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. Thanks for tuning in for another episode. This is the podcast that provides insights into what makes a great mobile game, what is and is not working for mobile game designers, and all the latest trends. Today's topic is going to be super interesting, and we've titled it Designing Your Audience for Mobile Games. So a bit of a spin there, not designing your mobile games for your audience, but designing your audience for your mobile games. That will become clear very soon. So I'm your host, John Jordan, and very pleased that joining us today is Dr. Richard Bartle. How's it going, Richard?
It's going fine. Yes.
Good. Pleased to hear it.
Yes.
So many of us kind of know what you've been doing over the years. You're pretty famous in the game space. But can we have a little potted history of kind of your what you've been up to?
Okay. So it will have to be potted because it covers a lot of time. So basically, like 45 or so years ago, when I was an undergraduate at the University of Essex, I co-wrote a game called MUD, Multi-User Dungeon, which is the forerunner. From which are descended almost all today's massively multiplayer online role-playing games. So anything World of Warcraft, Final Fantasy XIV, even things like Second Life, they're all direct descendants of this game I wrote, MUD. And after I've been running it for 10, 15 years, somebody asked a question about why do people play these games? And we had a big discussion amongst the administrators. And I mean, when I say big, it lasted about 3 months. and at the end, I thought, well, I'll summarize this now. It's petered out. And while I was summarizing, I noticed that people played for one of basically four different reasons, which I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. So I summarized it and sent it out to the players. And over the next few years I watched and it seemed to work. I thought, oh, that's useful, but I didn't do much with it. And then there was a journal came out, an academic journal called the Journal of MUD Research. I think it may have managed maybe 4 or 5 issues before people stopped sending in articles. But the very first one, I thought this deserves support. So I wrote up my findings and I call them player types. And that's what I'm generally known for outside the MMO industry, player types, which is... So although it was published in 1996, the original work was 1991, something like that.
So this is now known as the Bartle test. That's kind of what it's commonly known as.
Not by me. I call them player types. But
no, I know not by you. That would be a bit odd if you were calling your. But yeah, that's kind of what you're.
Yeah, it's like Higgs boson. He doesn't call it the Higgs boson. He calls it the boson.
Yes, it's kind of interesting that it was that sort of holistic kind of development that it sort of came out naturally from what was happening there, and it's become so kind of foundational to a lot of thinking about kind of player taxonomy, use the kind of professional word, and still being used today. So let's talk to Joel Junkunen. How's it going, Joel?
I'm great, thanks.
So you're head of analytics at Game Refinery by Vungle, as you're now officially known. And do you want to talk a little bit about kind of how you've been using some of these kind of basic kind of foundational thinking about kind of audiences and what they want in games? Because you've got your own Game Refinery motivations and archetypes kind of framework as well. So can you talk a little bit about how you took that and used that particularly for mobile, which is maybe certainly a little bit different to what the people playing MUDs all those years ago?
Of course. Yeah, I have to say that actually Dr. Bartle's work was one of the kind of foundations that we also kind of researched and checked when we started to do this. So it has been a big inspiration for us as well. Of course, as we are working on the mobile game space, we then start to see that because there are so many genres and mashups and the industry is a bit different. We needed to have a kind of framework that would work for the developers' needs that work in mobile game space. So actually we started by reviewing existing frameworks, both academic and commercial, and then we did a lot of interview with game developers, but also the players. So there was a significant amount of quality study involved as well. And then we learned, I would say, three key things when we did this initial research. First of all, of course, there were several existing frameworks, like the Bottles one, but most of them were, I would say, a bit focused on the PC and console world. Really great work and really extensive. But then when looking at some specific subgenres in mobile, for instance, we thought that there is something that we could maybe do or take a bit further. And second, many of these frameworks in the industry, they were really thorough. But when we talked with the developers and the game teams who were designing game features, like individual mechanics in games and especially in mobile games, sometimes these existing frameworks were a bit high level. So what we got requested was that, hey, could you guys, when you are researching those features and doing those surveys, could you kind of dig it a bit more detailed level from a mobile games, modern mobile game perspective? So that's where we kind of started, and then the last or the third point was that we needed to have a taxonomy or framework of motivations and player archetypes that we could use in all of these different genres and subgenres. Like in mobile game space, there are casual games like word games or puzzle games. On the other hand, or the other side of the spectrum, but then on the other side, there are really complex games like 4X strategy games or RPGs and those kind of mid-core hardcore games. So we need also a taxonomy that could explain and map the motivations of all these different types of players. So that's where we left off. But I would say that Dr. Bartels and the other academic study has been a great inspiration, and also without that, we wouldn't be here with the Game Refineries taxonomy as well.
So I guess, I mean, kind of we haven't actually said the four that you came up with, Richard, which is a bit amiss of us. So we have achievers, explorers, killers, and socializers. That was the kind of the basic framework that you came up with. Yeah, and I guess the kind of the niceness of that is it's not too complicated. We kind of, I guess, when people hear those, you sort of have an inherent kind of view on what people are going to be sort of doing in that kind of situation. I mean, Joel, how many did you come up with a fixed number of kind of archetypes?
We at the moment we have 8 archetypes. Actually, they have pretty much overlap with Dr. Bartels' archetype as well. Maybe some of them are kind of spliced and diced up to a more detailed archetypes, for taking into account the mobile game's nature. And then of course those eight player archetypes, we also have those 12 individual motivation drivers that then those archetypes, for if you have like a networker archetype, then that archetype is kind of really keen on certain of these 12 motivations. So we have both the motivations and then the archetypes.
I mean, Richard, are you kind of surprised that the, you know, all these, you know, 20, 25 years later, that the kind of the basically these core things that you came up with are still kind of relevant? Obviously, they've been kind of refined over the years, but that's, so, you know, for games, it's so dynamic. It's quite, to me, quite surprising that you hit the nail on the head there.
Well, yeah. When I originally published the article that I published, I didn't publish it to say these are the four player types. It was more like, you people keep designing games for yourselves. Okay, so if you design a game for yourself, one person at least is going to like it, you. But games don't need to be designed for yourself. You should be designing games for people, and people play for different reasons. Look, here are four reasons that I have found. I expected somebody would go away and come back 6 months later with, "Pah, those are rubbish. These are the real reasons people play." But as it happens, it seems that I was actually quite close. But for massively multiplayer games, there were some flaws with the original specification with four types. Particularly, there were different kinds of killers. And then when you look closely, there are different kinds of the others. And there was no explanation as to how players move between types, because for MMOs, people play them for a long time and they change their types as they play. And it didn't actually explain why they played them. It just said they played for these reasons. So I did expand that in 2003 for my book, Designing Virtual Worlds. So there are eight types now in total, but no one ever uses the eight types because eight's too big a number. They remember four, and they particularly remember it because it's got killers in there. They like the word killers. So it's accessible, and it's useful getting to grips with the idea that there are different reasons that people play games. And if you're designing a game, you probably ought to know why the people you're designing it for would be playing it. So I do seem to have come across something that just seemed to have uses, but really it's a tool. And for particular applications, you might want a better tool, one that's less of a, I mean, you can stick a screw into a piece of wood by using a hammer. It's not as good as using a screwdriver, but it's better than trying to use your teeth. So it's just a tool, and other people will have particular needs that have got more refined requirements than player types do. But the general principle is that there are different people who play for different reasons, and if you're making a game, you should probably know what those reasons are. And if it's a multiplayer game, then those different reasons, the players will all interact with one another, so you do need to service them all, not just your own particular, I'm an achiever, therefore everybody must be achiever or whatever.
It's worth pointing out, for maybe a lot of people don't know, that the games you talk about, these MUDs, were just text-based. So
yeah.
So these would be now seen as incredibly primitive sort of experiences, although, of course, for the people who were in them, they were, because there was no graphics to sort of get in the way, graphics weren't, obviously, couldn't really do graphics on many computers then, so they were kind of creating, the imagination was all created in their own brains, so it was kind of quite interesting.
Well, yes, well, what we're doing now is quite primitive. I mean, you're only 2D.
Okay.
And yeah, I only see you from the chest up. I mean, how many years do you want to wait before you're a 3D hologram standing in front of me? The thing about text, I mean, there is an argument that actually text is the end state, in that if you keep adding more and more and more to the interfaces, eventually you get to the point where text actually does what you want to do better. But no one's going to play text at the moment because it involves reading. And for video games, well, they want video. But we had to have text because there wasn't the bandwidth back then. It's just as well for me because although I can write very well, I can't draw for toffee. So, text. At one point, just before the World Wide Web came out and people could put pictures up, MUDs were accounted for about 11% of all the bits sent on the internet. Not a bad boast.
Good. I mean, Joel, we were talking. Obviously, you guys are looking at mobile. In terms of those kind of those, let's keep it kind of basic. Those four sort of basic kind of premises that we have: achiever, explorer, killer, and socializer. I mean, do you think they all are equally relevant for mobile games? I guess, as we said, kind of mobile games. Well, they can be very hardcore and similar to anything on PC and console. There obviously is a more casual and now hyper-casual sort of experiences, which we've never really seen before on other gaming platforms. Do you think the kind of gravity has kind of shifted? Are we seeing more games now that are kind of socialising more with the rise of kind of social networks than is that sort of the archetype that is kind of in vogue at the moment for mobile?
Yeah, I would say, as I said before, Dr. Bartels, the original four archetypes or player types are still very valid when looking at the high-level picture of even the mobile games. But then when looking at the current state and space of mobile game types and genres, I think the biggest difference is, in my opinion, that in mobile game space, there are a huge amount of genres and subgenres and genre hybrids that then, of course, affect that what kind of players. And also the audience is much broader. So that, of course, affects the what kind of framework can cover the whole space or at least a great extent of the space. So I would say that when looking at mobile game audience and comparing those to PC and for example, the MMOs, First, mobile gamers nowadays are a much broader group in people in terms of demographic characteristics like age and gender. And then many people actually to play mobile games don't consider themselves as gamers in the traditional sense of the world kind of word. So the audience is much more diverse. Of course, we are all still people, so similar kind of things motivate us, even if the decades roll by or whatever. But then I think now that we have in the mobile game space, we have so huge variety of game types with growing number of hybrids and mashups. It sets its own kind of requirements for this kind of taxonomy, an actionable taxonomy when looking from designer's perspective, which of course designers work with the nitty-gritty details and the feature mechanics, and for them to have a really actionable framework, we kind of needed to emphasize a couple of the characteristics that are more kind of suitable for mobile game space. So these two, I would say, characteristics affect the kind of people who are actually engaging with the product, and then meaning that in mobile they tend to represent the broader spectrum of users, and this in turn then affects the averages and means of what kind of motivations drive the mobile game audience in general in comparison to, let's say, MMOs and PC console today or even and then like a couple of decades ago.
In terms of, it's kind of interesting what you brought out there, that you kind of mentioned it as we age, and I guess, you know, these the kind of valid, the kind of the reason that these four kind of archetypes have survived, because it's very simple, but when we start to put on the matrix of, you know, we might as individuals sort of move, I guess, off the top of my head, you might think, you know, a lot of kind of teenage boys are sort of more killers, and then as we get old, we can kind of think they're more explorers or achievers or something like that. But equally, as you pointed out, I think, Richard, that you know, people play the same game over, you know, potentially over a fairly short period of time can change that as well. So it's kind of multi-dimensional, I suppose. Do you think even in sort of games like, if you think about a first-person shooter game, obviously that's going to be attract more of a sort of killer type of person, and that behaviour will be sort of dominant. But do you think, Richard, that designers should be thinking more about, even in these games where you think there's kind of a predominance of one type or one type of motivation, that you should sort of have good things to do for all four archetypes, or is that gonna, would you be better off sort of honing your design maybe for some titles just to one sort of behavior?
Well, the thing is that you need all four for the massively multiplayer games, because these are the things that people play for 2 to 4 hours every night for 18 months, 2 years, 25 years. People will play these things for ages, and they're like epic stories, like mythic stories that are like King Arthur, where it starts off, you know, the whole thing's covered. So of course they're going to develop as they play. But if you're going for a mobile game, then first of all, you want to choose a group that's going to pay you money, because if you don't, then, well, you're a charity. So you're going to aim your group at your game at some people who will at least pay you somehow. Now, unless the other player types are part of the content, then why would you address them? So if you're making a game that you think will really appeal to achievers, then, okay, would the achievers pay me any money? Well, some of them might, because they're not very good at achieving and want to give the impression that they are, so they might pay you something to give themselves a boost and tell themselves that they aren't cheating, but they know deep down they are. But other people, explorers, might think, well, this is a really interesting game. I could spend a lot of time playing it in order to gain access to these new and interesting mechanics and the depth and so on, but I'd rather just pay. Now, if you've got that kind of thing, then, yeah, you would make a game that would be aimed at both. But there's no point. If a game's single player, then there's not a lot of point in aiming at socializers, and also killers. The sense it's used in player types for MMOs is more of your griefer rather than your competitive wants PvP, player versus player. It's not really that that sense. It's more like, it's more people who get fun from making other people not have fun. So it really depends on the game. If you're looking for a game that you want people to play a lot, over an extended period and you're expecting to get money from him in dribs and drabs, then go for all four, because each player will act as content for the other players. But if you're aiming at something quite focused that's only going to be interesting to certain people, but it'd be really interesting to them, well, you wouldn't go for broad strokes like player types. You'd choose something that was particularly, say it was one of these find the hidden object games. Some people just like it because they like the actual seeking and finding. They get some fun from finding things, whereas others like, are more like completionists, and they get their fun from having found all of them. Now, you could map those onto player types. You could map them onto probably personality types. But if you're a game designer and you want to know what kind of players are playing that kind of search the hidden object, then you need to know your audience. And using a broad structure could help, but you probably want a more focused one by people who have made these kind of games and done an analysis that works very well for that one small group. So a specialist tool, like a goldsmith's screwdriver, which is a tiny little thing, but it's what makes your watches work.
Now, it's interesting to bring in kind of monetization as a motivation for people as well. So kind of, again, that's another layer, and maybe these different types monetize in different ways, but certainly different experiences. That's obviously particularly for mobile, where you're giving away all the content for free. Obviously, slightly different in MMOs, where hopefully you have a subscription sort of service, I guess.
Well, they do have subscription, but they also sell things, which really annoys a lot of players.
Do you think there's any sort of great examples of kind of games that have that you kind of think are have used this sort of framework to its kind of fullest extent? Is there any? I mean, I don't know whether ones you've worked on. I know you do consulting and stuff as well. Is there any? If people are kind of interested in maybe what would be a good game that you think kind of builds
what with massively multiplayer games? Yes, I mean some of those. Yeah, I mean pretty well everything from Ultima Online onwards has been designed with player types in mind. So it's influenced them all. And when you look at the games, you can see, oh, well, yes, the players do split into these different types. The counter argument is, well, of course they do, because they were designed to fit them. There might be all these other player types you haven't come across. but the theory does say that if people are playing for fun, then these are the player types that you will see, and they will progress through them in a certain way. But that only applies for MMOs. So if you're using player types outside of MMOs, well, I can't explain why it would work, but I can't say it wouldn't work. And if it works until you find a better tool, yeah, go for it. But there are, as Joel was saying, there are lots of people have done work in these areas. And when you look at them, yeah, you do find some differences, but mainly they're all much of a muchness. They all seem to be focusing on coming down to the same motivations, the same categories of things that they find enjoyable. And there might be some differences in different places, but really there's enough there that's so similar that you think, well, there is something to this now.
Yeah, after 25 years.
Yeah. I mean, some, for example, I don't have anything in my player types for immersion, which is the sense of the extent to which you identify with your character in a role-playing game. But some of the other ones do have that. Now, for me, immersion is a measure of how far you've progressed in your journey through the different player types. So it's sort of covered at a meta level. But for others, immersion is just a reason that people play games, to get immersed. So things, they come at them from different directions. And it's really, as a designer, it's which one is the most useful for you.
I'm just kind of thinking, obviously, as we kind of discussed, people can be different, take different kind of different approaches individually and over time. Did you think you are a, you know, broadly speaking, obviously, do you think you are a particular type, or if you sort of had to choose one?
No,
you don't. Okay.
No, I'm a game designer. You see, I don't play games for player fun. I play games for designer fun, which isn't the same.
Oh dear.
People play games for all sorts of reasons. They might play a game because they are an educator and they're playing the game to teach somebody, or they might be a journalist, they're playing it in order to learn to write about it. There could be a gold farmer who's playing a game in order to make money collecting game gold that they can then sell to other players for real money. There could be a designer looking at the game to try and figure out how it works. So those people aren't playing the games for fun, and you're not creating games for those people. You're creating games for the vast majority of people who are players. So if you are in one of those categories, then a player type wouldn't really fit, because you're like a meta gamer. So for me, I don't play games for player fun. I play them for designer fun. So I might find something a lot more fun than you do, because you think the game's boring, but I'm thinking, wow, that's really good how they put that together. I mean, okay, so the game sucks, but this is really interesting. Look at, if only they'd have done this, or, oh, I'm going to take that next time. So that's what, I mean, if you were to sit down and watch a movie and you were sitting next to Steven Spielberg at the end, you both would have seen a different movie.
Joel, did something that kind of jumps out at you? I mean, I guess, again, a bit like kind of Richard, you play games for work. So maybe the fun of playing a very obscure kind of Chinese mobile RPGs is probably probably less than Chinese RPG fans. But is it one that you kind of think is more you?
I would say... the way, based on our research and the way I see it, and I totally agree with Richard that I also kind of play games for work purposes. So I'm not maybe the best one to kind of analyze myself. But what we notice is that players and human beings might have kind of several key motivation drivers and reasons why they play the games and some particular game especially. So it's not always so black and white, even though we also in Game Refiner we have the gamer archetypes, player archetypes, but one individual player can be kind of mix of, let's say, a thrill seeker, as we call it, or a king of the hill or network or whatever. So it kind of depends, and they might, based on our research, the same people might play different games to kind of get the tackle the different motivations that they have. So they might, the same player might enjoy primarily strategy games and hardcore games for beating others and being the king of the hill or that kind of stuff, optimizing resource production. But then they might have this other state of mind where they are all about playing Sudokus or some puzzle games. So it's not always so black and white. And I think from designer's perspective, what we've also noticed, and there are a couple of examples from the industry and from the market, is that if you are able to find a kind of an experiment beyond the primary motivation or archetypes that you view as your key audience, is you might find something really, really valuable. The example I was going to say is that, for instance, the rise of so-called decoration or narrative mastery puzzle games, like Gardenscapes and Homescapes a couple of years ago, that are now a significant part of the whole puzzle genre. What happened there is that the designers realized that the people who love to play casual mastery games also enjoy the sense of accomplishment and progression towards set milestones. And then they realized that many casual gamers like the escapism aspect of light storytelling and narrative, and also being able to express themselves through decoration. And then games like Homescapes and Gardenscapes and many other titles that follow those two, they actually fit those other motivation needs beside the kind of puzzle solving and that the I would say traditional single dimensional mastery games used to kind of give players. And then when they realized that and they implemented the meta layers of narratives and decorations and building your own mansion, which has nothing to do with the actual puzzle solving or the mastery aspect core gameplay, they were able to increase the retention of their existing user base, but also luring players who are not that into plain puzzle gamers, but require the narrative and decoration aspects to fall in love with the game. So I think they are, at least in the mobile game space, as mobile games are so versatile, that you can put smash genres together and implement new features that at first glance you wouldn't things that fit a certain genre. And then they are able to kind of broaden the motivational spectrum of the game and hence lure in players that otherwise might not enjoy the games, like PvP shooters, like Counter-Strike in PC back in the day, and still, of course, one of the biggest games. When I was playing them like 15, 20 years ago, they didn't have any skins or decorations and that kind of aspect to them. But now that's one of the biggest monetizing aspects of those kind of games. Or Fortnite, which of course, which use metaverse features that you can hang out with other players and bring in the other kind of social aspect, not only the beating each other death in the Battle Royale setting, but also kind of hanging out together and well, they are throwing in some music concerts and whatever. But I think that's kind of my point here is that mobile games are diverse and great in the way that they give you the possibility to find new audiences when you understand what motivates not only your current gamer base, like the secondary motivation drivers, but also new players that wouldn't otherwise maybe even stick to your game. So there are a lot of options, but also, of course, it opens up many challenges for designers as well.
Well, I'm the only one then who I'm an explorer. I think I'm pretty. No matter what game I play, I'm afraid I'm obviously not professional enough to play games for work because I explore them anyway. Good. So we're coming to the end now of a sort of podcast. Obviously, we could discuss this for I feel a long time, but where do we think this sort of more generally this sort of a kind of motivational archetypal, you know, taxonomy thing is going? Obviously, we have a good foundation with these four. There's kind of different variations that people who are doing different sorts of games might use. Do we think over time and as we get sort of more data around kind of how people play and we can kind of monitor them that actually these tools just get incredibly complicated and incredibly kind of niche? And going back to your analogy, where our gold screwdrivers become tinier and tinier, and do you think there will always be kind of always be kind of innovation in this space and drilling down further and further? Richard, what do you think?
Well, you can drill down as long as you want. 100 years from now, yes, if we haven't got the AIs already that will be able to identify which games you personally as an individual would like, then we'll have them in the future. You can drill down as much as you like, but the trouble is that the further you drill down, the smaller the audience becomes. So, yes, you might be able to design the perfect game for one person, but is that person's nevertheless going to hand over as much money as if you designed a game that wasn't perfect but was still pretty good for millions of people? So yeah, it's basically the deeper you go, the more it goes, and at some point you've got to say, well, just take an integration of that's the area of this, and that's where's the optimum point. Because if you look in too much detail, then you've got a narrower audience. But if you've got too shallow, you've got you appeal to everybody, but not enough that they're going to give you any money, or even that they'll play your game for very long. So it's a balancing act. Personally, I think that the best games are made by people who are both crafts oriented and arts oriented. So if you're a game designer who's making a game based on some player types, and you've got, you say, okay, we need a game that's going to appeal to people who like ponies and they like hair. So we'll make a My Little Ponies-like game because we'll just identify what things people like and make the game about it. Well, if you do that, then the game designer who is very good at crafted game design will be able to create such a game with all the mechanics and so on. But there will be no art to the game. It won't be saying anything. It won't be speaking to the players. It'll just be effectively the game design is acting as a puzzle solver, but the puzzles are to do with the systems that are being created. But the best games are where the game designer can do that, because they do need the skills of the craft, but they're trying to say something to the players, because then they've got a vision, and the vision is an attempt to communicate through the game's systems. And for that, I think once more people become accomplished at the craft, we will move more onto the art, and then we'll be seeing games that are saying things to the players that have not been said before in any other medium, because games have got gameplay. No other medium has gameplay, so there'll still be that. But of course, there'll still be the people who just want to play card games on their phone. Everyone's different.
Ending on a philosophical note there. That's good, good. Joel, how do you see it? On the mobile side?
I think I totally agree with Richard. Of course, when technology goes further to the, let's say 10 years from now, there will be more options and opportunities for designers to create the kind of games that cater to different kind of motivations or speak to these different kind of archetype. But I don't, the way, like Richard said, that you can always kind of go to more detailed level, but then how actionable that is in the bigger picture, that's I think when we were designing the taxonomy, and when it comes to genres or features, whatever, you can always go deeper, but at some point it is not as useful anymore. It gets too granular, and then One thing we have also kind of noticed is that if a designer or company focuses on too narrow-mindedly on some, let's say, some genre, that they are very much into match three games, let's say, and they really kind of think about only what motivates match three players what kind of features we should implement here. But the great thing about mobile games is that they are really versatile, and you can think, and you should think outside the box. And the greatest innovations and many of the best performing games are actually a result of borrowing from genres that you wouldn't even think about borrowing from, and then making it work in your game and making it so that it speaks to your audience. And so if you only kind of you go deeper and deeper in let's say in some motivational or player archetype framework, you might actually lose the bigger picture and then miss many of the opportunities that actually come from looking at from the higher level. And as I said, I don't see us people changing that much or our motivation changing that much, us evolving as quickly as the market is evolving. So I firmly believe that the core motivations or the player archetypes, yes, there will be some changes and or variety in the longer term, but I would say that, like Richard pointed out, as we've been researching many of these different taxonomies and different ways of looking at things, they have different kind of some differences, but the overall similarities are there, and I don't see them changing too much. Then it's more about developers finding the way to how to cater to the key audience is the most lucrative audience from their perspective, and maybe the end result is the super AI that we just sit in a chair and it feeds impulses to our brains that trigger all of our motivations, and we don't have to do anything in the world anymore. But that's a big of a dystopia, but it might be coming.
Maybe end up there.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks. I think yes, a good sort of conclusion that we have these tools and the tool sets are sort of getting more refined and we can do more sort of delicate things with them. But I guess unless we have the spark of the kind of the art in the first place, then we're potentially just kind of becoming more derivative. So I guess it's always with the game design, it's always kind of a balance, I suppose, between the spark that kind of drives the passion and then the having the best tools you have to kind of then kind of craft that spark of inspiration into something that the people are going to love. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time, Richard. That was great. Thank you, Joel.
thank you.
Thanks. Yes, I wanted to hear more of Joel. What's that?
It's his dystopian vision.
We have to hang around after this is finished.
Well, you guys can have a private podcast afterwards and talk about scary AIs and things like that. But for us, thank you very much for listening and viewing now our podcast stroke video cast. I hope you're enjoying it and you are kind of sparking some inspiration in your mind as well about thinking, particularly about the mobile game space and how to make sort of great mobile games. That's what we're trying to do. We're doing podcasts regularly now, so whether you're listening via podcast or whether you're watching us now by video, please do subscribe and be great to get reviews, particularly on the podcast channels. That really helps other people find the podcast. But enough from me. Thank you very much for listening, watching, and come back next time to see what's going on in the world of the Mobile Game Dev Playbook.